Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 1st. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And there certainly is a lot to talk about. If we just concentrate on some of the news stories that have been coming out today before we move into the longer term, I will certainly attempt to frame what's been happening this week in terms of the longer term, because I think that there are a number of common threads running through a lot of the news headlines that we've had this week. Well, it's all about Bitcoin at the moment. Every news network in the world almost is talking about the fact that it surged through $10,000 this week. Now, this is an accelerating trend. But when we think about it, there has been a pivotal event, and that is that this has been a cash-settled market from its aegis less than 10 years ago. And now we're getting the introduction of leverage. Today, the CFTC and the SEC have permissioned CBOT and CME to launch futures contracts, and probably by the end of this year, so within the next few weeks. And that has lit a fire back under Bitcoin. It surged to a new high on the 29th, above 11,000, came rattling back down to 9,000. It's back up now into the mid 10,000s, almost 11,000 at 10,899. There is potential here for it to accelerate again higher, up until we get the release of the futures market. Then what has so far been a cash settled market will become a leveraged market, just like what we're accustomed to. Now, something that I've talked about must be ad nauseum is that there is the world of difference between a cash market and a leveraged market, because a cash market, where people are interested only in percentage gains, is best viewed on a logarithmic scale chart. And when we look at the log scale chart, we're presented with a series of consistency characteristics where we have a number of ranges one above another, where we get these accelerations on the upside, very sharp drawdowns, and support being found in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. Well, we're in the middle of another acceleration higher. If this is going to be a consistent trend, it will be followed by a sharp reversal. Now, we had the potential for that to occur just three days ago, when we got up to that peak at 11,434. But because we now have this additional factor of leverage entering the market, and it isn't in there yet, but it is certainly on the way, then has people front-loading their positions. They're buying in anticipation of that event. And it has the potential to be pivotal. It could represent a major uptick in what is already a volatile market. Now, right now, the margins that are available on Bitcoin are in the order of 20% for very small positions, up to 30 and 40% for larger positions. And that is a reflection of just how much volatility we have in this asset class. But then you have the potential for leverage to enter this market, and that could then represent an additional move in leverage. It means that the margin requirements are going to start off in the 30s and 40s, but they could rise if we get additional volatility, and that's almost certain considering how volatile this market is already. But it also introduces hedging and shorting, which isn't something you get in a distinctly cash market. So that is going to also have an influence, because there are no circuit breakers. This is a totally unregulated market so far. And what it also suggests is that we could be in for a roller coaster ride in terms of what this chart is going to do once those futures are up and running. So this is going to be, an asset class that is, or at least a sector, however one wants to describe it, it's going to be a sector that is going to continue to make headlines because so many people have made so much money. There, it is the epitome of a bubbly environment, because there is this perception that it could literally go to the moon, and that one will be rewarded for tolerating the the occasional drawdown. Now, that's something that we often see. In order to make a lot of money from Bitcoin, one would have had to have been a true believer, that you would have had to have tolerated pullbacks, often in the order of 50%. And that if you're willing to sit through that, then you don't have an exit strategy. So when this market then is so consistent, we have to monitor the consistency characteristics very closely, because when they change, then that is going to represent a change in the dynamic of the market. Right now, we know what the three consistency characteristics are, that it is liable to accelerate higher, it is liable to have very sharp pullbacks, but that the ranges are one above another. As long as the ranges are one above another, we have a staircase step sequence uptrend, and it's reasonably consistent. But as if that changes, then we are going to be in a much more risky environment. And those people that don't have exit strategies and have tolerated pullbacks in the order of 40, 50, 60%, well, they're going to get a drubbing in when this eventually turns around. Now, if we talk about it in terms of the philosophy of the market, the reality is that Bitcoin is really only a reflection of the underlying technology, which is blockchain. And blockchain is about a distributed ledger. And when we think about the way that the global economy has functioned until now, it was in large part disrupted by the disintermediation of the internet back in the 1990s. And what that did in many respects was to make markets more efficient, because it cut out the middleman, it took out steps in terms of the buying process, and that process is still ongoing. What we now have are we have producers, we've consumers, and then we have brokers. Amazon is in many respects a broker, but it is also a producer. It is increasingly moving into the position of being an upstream manufacturer. It is simply using OEM manufacturers to produce its own products, and then it is selling them to its very large network. And it is that network effect that has really been generated by the internet. Whereas Amazon has a retail network, Google has a search network, Facebook has a social media network, Microsoft has a network of operating systems on PCs, Apple has a phone network, and those are all the avenues through which these types of companies generate their revenue. So Netflix has a viewers network. We could simply go on. And then what we can also see is the evolution of this subscription model. Now, when you think about blockchain, then it has the potential to connect the supplier with the consumer directly. And that is its primary bullish consideration. But there are problems with it. When you have disintermediation, it relies upon the sustainability of the network. And the network effect for Bitcoin is totally reliant on users, and it is reliant on miners. Now, right now, the miners are being compensated by the value of the blocks that they are creating, which is where the value of Bitcoin comes from. But the reality is that that is not a requirement for blockchain to function. The reality is that we could simply have a payment mechanism. There is also the real issue that we have with the blockchain systems currently, is that because there are a limited number of blocks, because each block becomes progressively more difficult to solve, eventually the computing power required to solve the blocks is going to become problematic. And we have and in many respects, the evolution of quantum computing is going to represent a problem for cryptocurrencies such as they are currently constituted, because our entire a digital environment today is made up of ones and zeros. A switch is either on or off. But people will be familiar with the term multiple possible universes, but that is getting increasing commercial application in the terms of quantum computing, because a qubit doesn't necessarily have to be on or off, but it can be both at the same time. That the way a quantum computer works isn't to simply iterate through processes, but it is rather to examine every potential possible outcome in an infinity of possible outcomes and simply select the one that is most likely. And what that then does is that it creates not a good way of adding numbers, but of picking probable outcomes. And when we think about that, then the kinds of problems that quantum computers will be asked to solve are those that we simply cannot compute the answer to today. We will be able to ask completely different questions, but one of the questions that we could ask is, what is the key to a cryptocurrency account? Then, iterating through the infinite number of possible outcomes, it will come out with the most likely. And that is a key problem for the future of cryptocurrencies. And not only cryptocurrencies, but also the cybersecurity sector generally. They're going to have to come up with a way of securing the internet. It represents an existential problem. It actually represents the same kind of problem for the internet and for online payments that antibiotic resistance represents for the healthcare sector. And I think that that parallel is quite similar. This is not an intransigent problem. It isn't something that can't be fixed, but it is something that does have to be fixed. And it is also, of course, when we look at, for example, the performance of the cybersecurity sector, and sorry, I typed in the wrong ticker. When we look at the ETF, then it has been ranging higher, and it didn't quite break out in here this week. It will have to improve upon its performance next week. And we've seen just this week as well that there were a number of articles from both Google and from IBM about the prowess of their individual quantum computing networks, but this is still virgin territory in terms of evolution, and we're still a ways from a commercial product. But there will be a commercial product. It's only a matter of time, and that is going to represent a question for the cybersecurity sector, because when we look at the world around us today, we have a very big question that we could have more secure networks, and we could virtually eliminate the interference that we're getting from various foreign bodies, whether sovereign or private sector, let's put it that way, criminals. But the reality is that there isn't any great incentive to do so, that our own governments rely on the ability to use exactly the same kinds of tools that other governments use and criminals use to spy both on the domestic population and indeed on the global population. And we're seeing that moving into an industrial scale in China right now. China is recruiting its I think most prominent technology companies and tasking them with creating a system of control and I guess monitoring that is unheard of in human experience. That this is 1984 writ large, and it isn't really a question of if or when. It's happening today, and the number of cameras, the quantity of data that is being collected on everybody, and the The uses to which that is going to be put by the administration means that the Communist Party isn't going anywhere. They are going to ensure that any form of dissent is going to be neutered before it ever becomes a problem. And what that also suggests is that the individual freedom or liberty of citizens is going nowhere. Now, when we think about it in those terms, and people in the West have seen that the middle class has been hollowed out, and when, for example, we look at the A share market, we can draw a thread here. Back in 2015, it was the Chinese A share market surged higher because of the introduction of options. So that was a cash settled market in many respects that had the introduction of leverage on the retail sector that created this very bubbly activity, and then it collapsed. That is a realistic possibility for what we might expect from Bitcoin. It's the only recent analog that we have. But you can also see that since 2016, we've had a manufactured uptrend, and now we're getting some mean reversion, but the volatility has been squeezed out of this market by the control that the government has on the market. So we can't really look at the equity markets with an objective view, because it is so closely controlled by the government. Government bonds, on the other hand, give us something of a better understanding. Now, yields are up almost 150 basis points this year, but we do have to look at it on a longer term basis, and then the 4.5% level is the upper side of an almost decade, well, it's an over decade long range. So 4.5% represents really quite a key level for the Chinese government bond. What we've seen in China just this week is that there have been thousands of what are considered low-class people have been kicked out of their homes, and their homes have been demolished. And that's most particularly in Beijing, that they are clamping down on migrant workers for the simple reason that they believe that these people represent a potential threat in terms of the potential for unrest. So they're being kicked out of Beijing, and they're going to be spread out around the country. And that also happens at the same time that companies like Alibaba and JD.com and Baidu have been tasked with surveilling the entire population. So when we look at it in those terms, there are parallels with what is going on in China today with the pogroms that were going on in Germany, and that if we think about national socialism and think that it is the control of the state on all aspects of life, that corporations are permitted provided they exist to further the aims of the state and the party, then we have to conclude that there are some very clear parallels between fascism and the administration that we now see in China. And we can also go back and look at the parallels that the leading companies within a fascist organization do tend to do well, because they are offered monopolies by the state. They get to grow because the economy is very strictly regulated. But we also then have to begin to think about the longer term, and it is that China has got clear ambitions that it wants to be a first world power, both intellectually, militarily, and economically. It is that Eric Schmidt from Google was saying just this week that he sees that the real possibility that China will have artificial intelligence on par, if not better, than the USA within a decade. We also know that the The manufacturing sector for the clothing sector is intending to be fully automated within a decade. And the country is building a blue water navy. And the only reason that anybody builds a blue water navy is to project power internationally. So we know that that's happening. We also know that populations in the West have become pretty, I think, ambivalent towards the whole prospect of globalization. One of the reasons that globalization was accepted and indeed sold to populations was that it was going to deliver democracy to the world, that by helping people to evolve economically, that democracy would necessarily follow. But that has not been the case, and most particularly in places like China and Russia. And rather the opposite, what we see is that they are attempting pretty barefacedly to influence public discourse in the West through both sponsoring political parties or various institutes inside universities. And that is fuel for a backlash against globalization. And that is, I think, contributing to the in addition to the fact that one of the results of globalization has been to hollow out the middle classes in North America and in Europe. So we have dual focus there. And that is one of the things that has contributed to the fact that we have a rise of populism, xenophobia, nationalism, or even racism in a whole bunch of countries, depending on their individual characteristics. Now, what we've seen this week has been that the S&P 500 has done not a great deal. In fact, it was well off its low in here today. It was down to almost 2,600 and closed pretty much unchanged. So when you look at it on a weekly basis, you don't see anything at all, really, other than the fact that it is somewhat overextended relative to the trend mean. The Dow Jones has got some characteristics that I think we can now begin to to associate with acceleration. It was also well off its low in here today. Now, there are two big news items that were coming through. The first is that there is the possibility that the US is going to push through its or a hastily drawn tax code that is going to add to the deficit, but is going to represent a big tax cut for businesses. And that is good news, and that is the reason that the market has been rallying for more than a year already. In fact, the S&P 500 has turned in 13 consecutive months on the upside, and that's the first time it's done that in 80 years. So to say that this isn't a bullish environment would be a gross misunderstanding of just how well the markets have done. This, when we look at it on the 10-year basis, this period since the beginning of 2016 is much more consistent than any time since the beginning of the bull market in 2009. And what that represents is a widening of the imbalance between supply and demand. Now, if that is indeed the case, then we anticipate that trends become more consistent as they mature, because it makes perfect sense that if the imbalance between supply and demand is widening, then the argument for why markets should be going higher is more broadly accepted. And that is certainly what we're getting, that we are now in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, that central banks are beginning to curtail quantitative easing because the economy is recovering. That I think in Europe, in here today, the manufacturing index was at a 17-year high. So Europe is following on from a really depressed level to now firing on all cylinders. And that is also the case with Japan and just about everywhere else as well. So when you have a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and now you're getting fiscal stimulus, that's the epitome of a pro-cyclical policy, then that is going to contribute both to asset price inflation, but inflation generally. And there is the real possibility that these markets are going to climax in terms of the medium-term trend from 2009 with an acceleration higher. The fact that markets were pulling back today was related to the Mueller inquiry and the influence of the Russian administration in, I guess, or the just how much did the Russian administration influence the U.S. election? That is an awfully big question, and it lays bare this issue with globalization that a lot of people already have a problem with, but it could have geopolitical consequences. What we have certainly seen is that there has been an uptick in geopolitical tensions, and that is, as I think, what we can then think of is that this reaction against the status quo, where we have reactionary movements growing. And we have an election coming up in Italy in the not too distant future, where there is the real possibility that that anti-status quo parties are going to be in the ascendancy. So we know that this rise of populism is really only at the beginning, and the answer that many people want is higher wages. That is the thing that they have not had as a result of globalization, and it is a very simple solution that the vast majority of people have seen their standard of living decline, that savers have been robbed by very low interest rates, and speculators have been rewarded. Those that hold assets have been rewarded. Those that are renting assets have had to pay higher rents, and the result is that there are a lot of dissatisfied people, and the way to make them less dissatisfied is to give them more money. We're seeing that now in the USA with the pushing through of pro-cyclical policies, and that could contribute to an acceleration higher. We might get a little wobble when we get when we get the final blueprint of what the tax cuts are in fact going to produce. Push through because there has been a substantial rally in a buy the rumor, sell the news fashion. So we could get a wobble, but as long as the market is trending higher and is finding support in the region of the trend mean, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. I think it is important that the S&P 500 has not pulled back by more than 80 points in a year. And it would have to do at least that to even begin to question that we're not still in a bullish environment generally. Now, if this market does climax in a bullish acceleration, and it is the Dow Jones that has got the clearest evidence of it right now, then it will do so because of these pro-cyclical policies. We have to also think that the Dow Jones really rallying towards this 25,000 level is unlikely not to pause around it, considering that it paused for a brief time around 20,000. It bounced from 15,000 back in 2015, 2016. It's almost certainly going to pause around the 25,000 point level, but that's still 800 points from where we are right now. Trend endings only come in three different categories. The first one is acceleration. The second one is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And we saw evidence of that in some of the technology shares this week. Autodesk is an example. That is a massive downside key reversal following what was an incredibly impressive advance from the lows back in early 2016, where the market went up over 200%. But this has capped it for at least the short term. So we're definitely getting some rotation out of some of the tech sector that has done best and into some that have been doing less well. One of the primary beneficiaries of tax cuts will be the banking sector. And the banks were not quite able to hold all of the advance this week, but they're closing out up on the week and reasserting on the upside. Then we have the retail sector, which has been under a cloud for much of the year, or at least the last 2 years. Let me just type that ticker in once more. And Macy's has now broken its progression of lower rally highs with enthusiasm that it will at least benefit from tax cuts, being a domestic US business, that it could do better. Kroger, which is a large supermarket chain, has also done better in here this week. So there is the potential for some rotation out of highly levered and shares that have done very well, and into those that have done, well, to say less well is a bit of an understatement, considering just how much the retail sector has pulled back this year. Now, within the context of the medium-term bull market, we know that interest rates are beginning to rise, and we know that we're getting pro-cyclical policies. So the pro-cyclical policies will last for a while, and then we'll be in a more indebted situation, and interest rates will be higher. So that is potentially going to set us up for problems in future. And that is what the yield curve is beginning to show us, because it's down now to 58 basis points. It's been falling pretty much all year, but it has really contracted over the last few months. At some point next year, we could be a lot closer to zero. When it eventually goes below zero, then we'll have anything between 6 and 18 months before the next recession. And then that will be, I think, a pretty substantial question as to exactly what can we expect from assets in the next recession, because interest rates are unlikely to be back where they were before the last recession. And the five-year yield is, I think, where we have the clearest indication of what is likely for the US market, because the majority of US debt has got, or I guess the average duration of all of US debt is about 5.5 years, and the average yield is about 1.9. Well, the 5 year is at 2.1. It's at the upper side of this range. It has first step above the base characteristics. We may see some consolidation right here, but the most likely scenario is that we're going to get an upward break. And what that represents is higher borrowing costs for the US government. And that would be the bond market's vote on the impact that the tax cuts are likely to represent. And considering just how much debt there is, that US government debt has doubled since 2008, then that represents a potential issue. And not least, and we know that that is also why the Federal Reserve is beginning to reduce the size of the balance sheet, because they have so much debt that is maturing next year. And we look at the Fed's balance sheet has done pretty much nothing since the end of 2014, and when it does begin to contract, that is going to represent what Jeff Gundlach has termed quantitative tightening, if the expansion of the balance sheet was quantitative easing, and it could have repercussions in the markets. Well, obviously, something that Warren Buffett says is that you don't know who has been swimming naked until the tide goes out, and the removal of all of that money is going to represent an issue, but not yet. There's no evidence that high yield spreads are expanding. In fact, they've been almost completely inert this year. And that's also the case for volatility. And it isn't simply that the S&P 500's volatility has been low, but it's been at record lows. And the bond market's volatility has been at record lows. But this is not only a reflection of the fact that volatility is low, but that it is a reflection of the the kinds of strategies that are working best in this particular environment. There are three that have really done particularly well. The first is passive investing. That active investing has really hasn't got much to show for itself, considering that the majority of asset managers had were pretty much closet trackers in the first place, and they rolled the markets up and all the way back down again in 2008. So people have been investing in ETFs, which are in many respects just almost like a derivative play on the market. But what they are really doing is outsourcing the management to the index. What that also means is that they are earnings agnostic. By buying the entire index, you are buying the good with the bad, and that you have survival bias, because the good companies survive, the bad companies eventually disappear, and what you end up with is an index that is doing reasonably well. And that is certainly something that has helped a lot of investors. By simply buying ETFs, they have ridden the market higher, and the market has been trending in a consistent manner, which has compounded their conviction that that was a good idea. But particularly in broad stocks, or broad stock market indices, where you're going to have a range of companies, some that are doing well and some that aren't, some that are large and some that are small, but also those that are benefiting from the conditions such as they are. That eventually, when the conditions change, then that is going to have an impact on the indices, and that will then also have an impact on passive investing. Then you have risk parity strategies. Because we have such low volatility, and because that volatility pervades all asset classes, not just the equity markets, that correlations between bonds and equities can be optimized, and that has allowed large investors to have long positions in the equity market, which can be offset or laid off against positions in the bond markets. So that has also contributed to this lower volatility. And then you have quantitative strategies, which are treating the shorts in or short positions in volatility as a yield enhancer. And when you look at, for example, the leverage short VIX index, what you're getting is a very persistent move, and most particularly since the beginning of 2016. So you can see clearly that the correlation between very low volatility or shorting the VIX index, which in many respects is selling time, because the reason that it's profitable is that most of the options written will expire before they can be exercised, then what you're doing is you're selling time. And because we've had such a low volatility market, then this strategy has worked pretty much flawlessly. Now, eventually that will no longer work. And the big question is what happens with interest rates. Interest rates are rising. There is no question of that. And eventually they will represent a headwind. And when that happens, then we're going to have a problem in the bond markets. That there are a substantial number of countries are trading on debt to GDP ratios that are rather extravagant. That there is a substantial amount of foreign currency debt outstanding. Russell Napier is pointing out Turkey and the 6% level on the Turkish 10-year is, I think, really quite a key level, considering that it represents the upper side of the base formation. But when we think about it in terms of just about everything, that quantitative easing has had massively distorting effects on just about all asset classes, but most particularly on the bond markets. And when we look at any major market, then we can look at, for example, the even still German debt out to 7-year maturities is at negative interest rates. And that's a pretty profound state of conditions. So, and it's also it represents a contradiction in the market. And when you have these kinds of contradictions, it really means that that is where you're going to have the next big problem, because tolerance of contradiction is something that we witness in just about all major crowds, and the bond market globally is an awfully big crowd. So these high debt to GDP ratios and the fact that we have had this contradiction of negative interest rates is something that is going to create a problem in future. But as we've looked at all the charts already, it's not a problem just yet. So I think that that's a very important characteristic. When we think about the and I know I'm very conscious of the fact that I've focused on some of the negative connotations from the evolution of various themes so far. But the reality is that we're in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, but we're still in the early stages of a secular bull market. And I think that that is by far the most important consideration, that bonds are virtually allergic to inflation. And I think that with the rise of populism and the rise of dissatisfaction among the middle classes and people voting for whatever political solution is proposed that delivers higher wages, well, that virtually ensures that we're going to have an inflationary outcome. The Dow Gold Ratio bottomed back in 2011, and it has staged a very impressive rally, and it is now up to a ratio of almost 19. We can see from this long-term ratio that that the peaks are between 35 and 36 years apart, and that each peak is successively higher than the other, and that would suggest that the next substantial peak in the Dow Gold Ratio will be somewhere in the mid-2030s, and it will be above 40. So that suggests that between now and 2035, the Dow Gold Ratio is going to double. If gold stays still, then the Dow will double. Now, I don't think that gold is going to stay still. I think that gold prices have been ranging for almost 2 years already, and that was following a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. So I think that gold is setting itself up for a breakout at some point next year, and that could potentially be the result of inflationary issues coming to the fore. But I think that the market to watch most for signs that inflation is returning is Japan. I think it is a very important question whether, despite the conclusion that everyone had that that Japan did it all wrong, that they failed to generate inflation all the way through the 90s and the early 2000s, and indeed up until now, because they employed the wrong policies. But I think that's actually the wrong question. The much more important question is, could they have done anything at all to generate inflation when we had one of the greatest disinflationary periods in history? If that is the more relevant question, is the fact that Japan is breaking upwards now an indication that we are entering a new inflationary period on a secular basis? If that is indeed the case, well, then Japan is the place where we're likely to see it first. They're the economy that have been trying to generate inflation longest. They've taken some of the most extreme measures to generate inflation, and there is the real possibility that they are going to succeed. Well, that's not particularly good news for the currency, and it's certainly not particularly good news for the bond market. But the equity market is one of the best hedges against inflation that there is, because companies have the ability to raise dividends, and they can raise dividends faster then inflation rises. And what that contributes to is asset price inflation and appetite for equities. And if you need any example at all of how a stock market can reflect inflation, well, then we have a very graphic example in Venezuela, where the market has simply gone vertical in the last year. And that is just a pure reflection of the domestic inflation rate and just how dire the situation is there. But if that is the case, then we should also be looking at commodities. Commodities generally do better in an inflationary environment. And oil prices were up a dollar in here today and have continued to find support above the $60 area. And I know that I have been one of the most bearish people about energy for really quite a long time, that at this service we were out in front back in 2007, 2006, pointing out the evolution of shale gas and shale oil and how much of a game changer that was going to be for the global energy sector. And it has contributed to prices staying below $60 for just about 3 years. But we're in a different situation right now, where some of the world's major producers are attempting to reduce the supply globally. We are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, so demand is increasing. And despite the fact that there is a great deal of additional supply out there on the sidelines, that what the majority of major companies have been doing is reducing the amount of money that they're spending on exploration because they're uncertain about what the price outlook is going to be. So that also has to, what also has to be brought into consideration is the fact that a lot of the shale drillers are marginal operations that rely on credit to sustain their drilling momentum. And if interest rates are rising and credit markets begin to contract, well, then that is going to have an impact on their ability to increase supply. So there is the potential that oil prices can rally from here and that they can move up to a level which will then become undeniably profitable for a number of what are today still reasonably marginal operations to increase their supply. There is a lot of oil sitting outside of OPEC in Canada, Brazil, and in North America, or in the USA. And all we need is higher prices to bring it back into the market. But perhaps $63.69 is not quite enough to get it there just yet. And if we look at the contract table, then we can see that prices are still pretty tight, that you can hedge out to November 19 at $58. I suspect that when you can hedge out to 2019 at $65 or maybe even $70, that there will be a flood of activity in the unconventional oil and gas sector. In the meantime, this remains and looks like a bullish chart pattern, and that means we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So when, for example, we look at, for example, Royal Dutch Shell, and it is up testing its peak, then the likelihood is that any consolidation that we get is likely to be, reasonably moderate, and that the outlook is likely to be really quite bullish. And when we look at the oil and gas producers index on the S&P 500, then the likelihood is that it is going to continue to find support in the region of the trend mean and be able to improve from here. And when we look at the mining sector, then the FTSE 350 mining index is about the most accurate global index, and it is now back in the region of the trend mean. So this, I think, is also indicative of the fact that we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, that it is cyclical sectors are beginning to pick up. We've already looked at banks, and we've looked at the the mining sector, and these are purely cyclical sectors. They tend to do best in that period where growth is picking up, but interest rates have not yet risen enough to choke it off. And that's exactly what we're seeing. These are not lead indicators. These are not the kinds of things that we'd look at to peak first. In fact, they're most likely to peak last, and that they will continue to move on to new highs while the rest of the market eventually rolls over. And within the technology sector, I've spoken in previous audios about the evolution of the subscription model, which is another way of thinking about the rise of dissatisfaction among the middle class, because the number of companies that are targeting just incremental money flow or cash flows on a monthly basis, that what it does is it creates utility type cash flows for the company, but it represents a constant drain on cash flow from the consumer. And that there is the rising perception that in order to have a modern lifestyle, that you need to have all of these additional services that represent cash flow negatives every month, so that when one's wages have not been rising, but the expenditures have in order to maintain what is considered a normal lifestyle, then that is both a positive factor for the subscription-driven companies, but it is a negative factor from the perceptions of the consumer. But biotechnology has not yet successfully been able to generate subscription models. It is the epitome of the cyclical nature of the technology sector, and it is back in the region of the trend mean and was bouncing in pretty impressive form in here today. And as long as it is bouncing and holding the progression of higher reaction lows, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. What I am looking at closely is these kinds of companies that have done fantastically well with very low or non-existent earnings, but where they've been borrowing money left and right. Tesla has done it better than anyone else. It has gone to the equity markets, it's gone to the bond markets, and it's gone to its own consumers to raise cash. And it is holding here still around the $300 area. That is below the trend mean. It really does need to bounce from this area. If it fails here, then that is, I think, going to be a warning shot across the bow of the highly leveraged debt markets. And after all, Tesla is a B minus credit, which puts it on a par credit rating wise with Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is doing a lot of things better, and it might indeed get a credit upgrade before Tesla does. In fact, it was also interesting in here this week that Argentina has been upgraded by Moody's, and that index has done really quite well since Macri was voted in. When we look at the currency, the fact that it has been allowed to float and has been reasonably steady over the period since the devaluation is a testament to the fact that performance on the Argentinian market is not quite the same as what we've seen in Venezuela. When we look at what is happening in technology, there was another piece of news in here this week that the first medical device to work in conjunction with the Apple Watch was permissioned by the FDA. So you'll get an EKG from your Apple Watch by using this wristband. And I think that that is the thin end of the wedge. That with the evolution of biotechnology, and the miniaturization of wearables and monitors, that it is inevitable that we're going to have this build out of I think monitoring, and also from not only from monitoring, but also that the pace of innovation in biotechnology, and most particularly in genetics, has accelerated beyond recognition. That with an aging population, there's a lot of money being poured into anti-aging, research and considering death as a disease rather than as the end result. What there is the realistic possibility that people are going to be living longer, healthier lives. And that could change I think the way that economies are set up right now. When we look at Europe in particular, they have large aging populations with declining populations overall and rising costs of elder care. And that is something that is quickly evolving in the USA as well. And it's something that is going to evolve in China in the not too distant future as well. And we've already seen that in Japan. Innovation in the healthcare sector is something that can have profound effects over the long term. It's at least as important as demographics generally. And of course, the country that has got the most favorable demographics and in tandem with improving governance is India. And the evolution of the access to online businesses and banking and social media for the Indian population is something that is rather profound and is likely to continue to generate growth there for the foreseeable future. And that doesn't mean that India is going to be immune from occasional pullbacks, but it does suggest that it is going to be a buy the dips kind of market for the foreseeable future. And I think when we think about the nature of the market, that when we think about what it is that is going to really drive innovation, is going to drive improvements in the human experience for the next 20 years, then we really don't have to look very far beyond healthcare and technology and indeed energy. That energy prices right now are rallying, and we know that that's happening for very specific reasons. But there are incredibly exciting things happening in terms of battery innovation. And that is another game changer for the global economy. That the very real prospect that within the decade we're going to have batteries that are competitive with internal combustion engines is, I think, something that was never really priced in until quite recently. And that is going to have a profound effect and going to have a massive impact on just about all areas of the economy when it is twinned with autonomy in terms of driving. It also means that the gap between rich and poor is going to continue to be an issue. It also, but of course, means that we're going to have productivity gains. And the question then is, how is wealth going to be redistributed? That in a constitutional democracy where everybody has a vote, then there is going to be a solution which is either going to be pro-growth or it's going to clamp down on a regulatory basis on the disintermediation of the workforce. Technological innovation is happening at such a rapid rate and is happening in many respects outside of the visual sphere that some of the greatest technology that we're seeing is on the software front, and that's largely invisible. And that is where we're seeing some of the greatest disruption as well. So cars will be running both on, I think when it really starts off, it's going to be that they'll be making decisions individually, but with the evolution of 5G networks, the likelihood is that cars are going to be able to communicate in a hive manner, much the same way that that Waze does today in a reasonably primitive manner to direct traffic. That cars talking to one another will eventually eliminate the requirement for drivers entirely, and having drivers will then be something that is rather more of a liability than a bonus. And Google is probably the company that is going to have a fleet of driverless cars first. And I haven't typed in the correct ticker, but it is interesting that Google and Facebook also posted downside key reversals this week. So what that suggests is that we are in for at least a pause in the commodity sector, excuse me, in the technology sector. What I think is particularly interesting about Google is that it has paused at round numbers on successive occasions. It is the epitome of a consistent trend. Now, when it stops pausing at round numbers, when it sustains a move below the trend mean, that is when we need to then ask big questions about the market. And so far, it has been as much a beneficiary of the size of the company and the rise of passive investing and the quantitative strategy of buying the dips as any other share. So there is the potential that it could rally more in here next week. But so far, it is sitting on a downside Q reversal for this week. So that would suggest that we are in a corrective phase for the technology sector generally, and that certainly a rotation is underway. When we look at the long term, then we have the rise of the global consumer. We have technological innovation, which is going to be both a tailwind and a headwind for the global consumer. And we have revolutions in the energy sector, which is an unmitigated success story from the perspective of the consumer. So it is going to be in the next 20 years that living standards are likely to improve beyond recognition. That or that we are going to have I think, a rise in inflation. And inflation would probably mean that people get more money, they have more choices on how to spend it, but that the cost of everything rises too. That would be beneficial from the perspective of companies because they would get pricing power back, and that would help to drive inflation. But it would be disastrous from the perspective of the bond markets. Anyone who has been long bonds and overweight bonds, and most particularly on a yield to maturity basis, is going to have a significant problem. And that represents a sea of money that could drive a bull market in equities over the long term. In the meantime, this medium-term bull market is maturing. There is a strong likelihood, I think, an increasingly strong likelihood that acceleration is how it will eventually peak. And then the next problem is likely to be in the bond markets. In between then, the cyclical sector should be among the better performers globally. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.